This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark This, a Straits Times podcast in which we talk about books and the headlines and recommend to you new reads. I'm Olivia Ho and I am joined today by my co-host, Toh-Wen Lee.
Hello.
Today we are going to do our annual Booker Prize rundown, and I think this is the fourth time that we're doing it. Wow, time passes. Wow. Crazy stuff. Anyway, so this year, the six contenders for the £50,000 award are A Passage North by Anuragprakasam, The Promise by Damon Galgut, No One Is Talking About This, Patricia Lockwood, The Fortune Men by Nadifa Mohammed, Bewilderment by Richard Powers, and Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. So last year's Booker shortlist was quite a shocker for us. I think perhaps it's considered to be the most diverse in recent memory. Lots of debuts. The writers are mostly women and of color. The year before that was a year with a lot of heavyweights. Margaret Atwood was one of the winners. What do you think of this year's lineup, Wendy?
Yes, yeah, it's a pretty diverse lineup this year. Quite a few Americans as well, I think, which may raise eyebrows among some in some quarters. The three books I focused on for this podcast, which were Damon Galgut's The Promise, Nadifa Mohammed's The Fortune Man, and Anuragprakasam's A Passage North, were clearly written by authors who can write. They were well written, the prose does stand out. But they just seem to like that extra zing. I'd say that I admire all of them, but I don't exactly love them. You know how sometimes when a book is objectively good, but it just doesn't resonate with you. So that seemed to be the case for me, at least with the three titles I was focusing on this time around. I was kind of hoping for a novel piece of writing that might, you know, break out of old conventions or do something really new and radical with form, you know, something in the vein of Anna Burns' Milkman, a title that won the Booker a few years ago. I was hoping for something like that, but I didn't quite get it with the three books I was reading for this podcast. And it made me wonder if the genre of literary fiction has, you know, begun to grow somewhat stale, or whether it's just me growing really impatient with fiction in general. I don't know. I don't know whether the Booker Prize is still relevant anymore, but maybe, Olivia, you might have had more luck with your titles. Do you have a favorite so far?
Well, on the long list, my favorite was Kazuo Ishiguro's Clara and the Sun, which didn't make it to the shortlist, so I'm a bit gutted about that. But failing that, I am rooting for Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. It's this, you know, if we're talking about books that you love when you read them, like this book is so huge and ambitious and beautifully written. I adored it. So it begins with the line, "I was born to be a wanderer. I was shaped to the earth like a seabird to a wave. Some birds fly until they die." So this is written by the aviatrix Marion Graves. So she's this fictional pilot who is who becomes an aviatrix in the early part of the 20th century. She's an infant in 1914 when she and her twin brother Jamie are on this catastrophic shipwreck. Their father is the captain, and he has to go to prison for causing the shipwreck. So they're basically abandoned orphans, almost, even though their father is still living. So they have to be sent to Missoula, Montana, which is this mountainous region, and live with their uncle Wallace, who is a painter. And then Jamie he grows up very sensitive. He becomes vegetarian. He's artistically inclined. Whereas Marion, she is more androgynous. She yearns for flight. She wants to. She sees these pilots when she's young, and they take her up in a plane, and then from then on she dreams of flying. So of course, bearing in mind that this is, you know, the 1920s, and there's not a lot of women flying at this time, so it's quite hard for a poor girl in Montana to become a pilot. And she manages to do so because she draws the attention of this gangster called Barclay McQueen, and he pays for her flight lessons. But he's also obsessed with her. Eventually, they get married, and she's like 17 at this point. So that's a very problematic relationship as well. And eventually, what Marion will go on to do is that she will go on to take this circumnavigational flight around the globe, which at the time was in the 1950s, and she will disappear over Antarctica and never be found again. So that's one half of the circle. The other half is set in 2014 Hollywood in Los Angeles. And that's then it's told by from the point of view of Hadley Baxter, who was this former child star that's become mired in scandal because she was in this blockbuster movie franchise called Archangel, which seems to be like a riff on Twilight, basically. Many films, huge young adult fan base, and then she's been in a relationship with a co-star, but then she cheats on him and is very publicly outed for it, and then her career goes into free fall. Nobody in Hollywood will touch her except for her eccentric neighbor, who is this who gets her involved in this film project that is a biopic about Marion Graves. So Marion and Hadley have a lot of parallels, because Hadley was also orphaned at a young age and raised by her dissolute uncle, and she lost her parents in the plane crash, so she's very drawn to Marion's story. And they're both young women in a time where they're trying to navigate societal expectations that are being pressed upon them, and they don't really know what it is that they're looking for, but they're both searching for this kind of freedom. And so usually when you get this kind of dual narrative, it can fail quite easily, because there's one strand, usually it's the more modern strand, that doesn't provide adequate ballast for the other strand. I think a lot of people disagree with me about this, I've seen in reviews, but personally I felt that this was one of the rare instances of near perfect balance, because Marion's story is very fascinating. It could easily have overwhelmed the narrative, but then Shipstead is able to modulate it. And Hadley, even though she's so self-absorbed, she's this pop star, she's Hollywood starlet, she's very self-destructive in her behaviors, and she could have been very annoying. But I found her that she had a surprising depth to her. And of course, the writing is just beautiful. It's just there's so much delight that Shipstead takes in flight, in the way that the earth looks from the air. She describes these rock layers and mountains as being wrapped like taffy on the mixing hook. I'm going to read this passage of Marion's flights in Alaska. She says, "Once a corpse smells so bad she lashes it to the wing. Once a woman gives birth in her plane. Once she lands on the frozen surface of the Chukchi Sea to rescue the passengers of a ship locked in ice. Somewhere she picks up a Russian word, Polynya, for the patches of open water in the sea ice where the whales come to breathe. The landscape is secretive and harsh and impossibly immense, and she borrows some of its inscrutability for herself, its disinterest in human goings-on. Unfriendliness is another form of camouflage." So the other thing that's really stunning about this book is the sweeping volume of research that goes into it. There's so much detail. Shipstead writes about the science of navigation. She weaves in the story of this gender-fluid indigenous warrior who is dubbed Sitting in the Water Grizzly. And this is actually quite relevant to the plot later on. There are also all these real-life women pilots whose stories, are woven into the landscape of Marianne's, like Amy Johnson, the first woman who flew solo from London to Australia. Eleanor Smith was this very young daredevil aviatrix who flew under four New York City bridges on a dare. There's Jacqueline Cochran, the speed queen who broke the sound barrier and is also like a beauty maven. And of course, there's Amelia Earhart, who is the most famous aviatrix of all time. And she's a background presence, but it's very clear that Marion's story is mapped onto hers. And it's just a book with enormous scope of ambition. One of its goals is to compact infinite space into a single work of art, to compress a life into, a legacy. And of course, this is unachievable. Marion in the book, she says that, "I wish to measure my life against the dimensions of the planet." And that's impossible. And you have to fold things up. But at the same time, the effort is so commendable. I really enjoy this book a lot.
Yeah, truly a broad sweep.
So further on the subject of historical fiction drawn from real-life figures, we have The Fortune Men by Nadifa Mohammed.
Yes, so this novel by Somali-born British writer Nadifa Mohammed is based on a true story. It's set in 1950s Cardiff, where a young Somali sailor, Mahmoud, was hanged after being accused of the brutal murder of a shopkeeper. This was later described as a wrongful execution. So in 2015, Nadifa Mohammed decided to find out more about the story. And along the way, she learned that her father actually knew Mahmoud in the late 1940s and early 1950s. She grew more interested in the Somali diaspora in Tiger Bay, which, as it turns out, was one of the most multicultural areas in Cardiff. So I feel that in this book, Nadifa Muhammad does a good job, you know, conveying the colorful, noisy world that Mahmud inhabits. I didn't quite take to this novel. It just somehow didn't seem to grip me, but the language is undeniably evocative and there are some really lovely turns of phrase. You had a favorite line in the novel, right, Olivia?
Yeah, I think it's the singing line. It goes, "I will wrap the road around my waist like a belt and walk the earth even if no one sees me." Then he holds his palms out as if the sun is a ball he can catch.
Yeah, such an arresting image. Another book nominee I was looking at was A Passage North by Anuk Arutpragasam. So in this novel, the protagonist is Krishnan, who's a young man in Sri Lanka. And the book, you know, largely consists of thoughts that float in and out of Krishnan's head on a train journey to the north of Sri Lanka. So at the start of the book, we learn that Rani, the woman who cares for Krishnan's grandmother, has died. She was visiting a home village and she fell into a well. So we follow Krishnan on his journey to Rani's village to attend the funeral. And along the way, he thinks about all manner of things, from Rani to mental illness, to his aged and aging grandmother, his ex-girlfriend Anjum, the Tamil tigers, and nuggets of Indian folklore and mythology. So the absent center of this book is, in fact, the Sri Lankan civil war, as well as the atrocities committed by the government and the lingering trauma these events have had on the lives of people, you know, like Rani and her family. The tone of the book is, well, it's muted, introspective, and occasionally meandering. I'm just going to read out a passage from one of the scenes describing Rani's funeral, the noisy mourners at her funeral. They're crowding around her casket. I quote, "Krishnan still couldn't tell how genuine most of the lamentation was, but it occurred to him as he was pushed towards the center of the room, his feet trampling and trampled by the feet of the others crowded around him, the heat of their bodies and their breathing pressing in against him, that perhaps he was wrong to think of lamentation in terms of sincerity or insincerity, that perhaps the crying and wailing and sobbing all around him was intended not as an expression of emotion, but as a kind of service offered to the bereaved, a performance in some sense, but a performance that, together with the drums and the rituals, was meant only to help the bereaved with their own lamentation, to ease out when the calm, rhythmic words and firm kneading hands of a midwife during a difficult birth, the tears the bereaved so often found impossible to bring out by themselves." So the author's writing is, well, it's very pithy, it's very quotable, and there's some really fine turns of phrase. For example, there's one scene where he talks about sleeping patterns of, you know, the characters becoming more regular and no longer a capitulation to fatigue as it had been earlier. As someone who struggles with sleep deprivation occasionally, this capitulation to fatigue is something I'm unfortunately quite familiar with. So I thought it was a great way of summing up that feeling, you know, of being so tired, you just have no choice but to fall asleep. Yeah. So I think how much you enjoy this book will depend on whether or not you enjoy inhabiting the mind of the protagonist Krishnan, who admittedly isn't as interesting as the people he is thinking of and talking about in this book. It is full of some pretty long, windy sentences, and occasionally it feels a bit like sailing through fog. Maybe it's just me being sleep deprived. I don't know. I feel it would appeal to a certain sort of reader who appreciates writers who spend a long time polishing the sentences, because the writing is very impressive. It just takes a bit of endurance to get through to the end.
Capitulation to fiction. Now, if you like what you're listening to, subscribe to our podcast series, Bookmark This, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Like us and give us a rating too. Back to our show and on to our next book. So we've been talking about the first-timers on the shortlist. Now let's take a look at the heavyweights. The biggest name on the list is probably Richard Powers, who was on the shortlist in 2018 for The Overstory, which Wendy reviewed in our very first book roundup for this podcast. And then he went on to later win the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for that book. The Overstory was more than 600 pages long, quite epic. Bewilderment is less than half that length. It follows this widowed astrobiologist, Theo, whose job involves programming simulations of life on extrasolar planets. Theo's 9-year-old son, Robin, has been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, obsessive compulsive disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And on top of this, he's grieving his mother, who was this very passionate environmental activist who was killed in a car accident. And he is also very affected by the worsening climate crisis and how helpless he feels in its face. So he becomes increasingly volatile. He acts up violently at school, harms a schoolmate, and then the school authorities threaten to expel him. Theo doesn't want to give his son psychoactive medication, so instead they turn to this experimental neurofeedback therapy. And then this is where the book gets a bit science fiction-y. The therapy is modeled on the mind of Robin's mother, and she was an early test subject of the program. So he basically enters into her mental landscape and learns her moods. This world is a very dystopian world. We appear to be in the second term of a Trumpian presidency, which probably when the novel was being written was a very real possibility. And it's an incredibly grim prospect. There is a parallel in the book. It's drawn to the story Flowers for Algernon, which if you've read it, it's about the experimental technology that enhances the intellectual capacity of a man with low IQ. So don't want to spoil too much, but if you know how that story goes, then you know that it's not going to bode very well for Theo and Robin here. I didn't read the overstory, though. Wendy liked it, I think.
Yeah, it was a good book. Just very long.
Okay. Yeah, but I don't love this book. I don't love Bewilderment. Perhaps I think because it's, you know, unlike the overstory, which was very sprawling and covers so many things, Bewilderment is very compact. It's very focused on this father-son duo. So you don't get that expansiveness of the natural world that an ecological novel should draw on. Instead, this novel just kind of closes in on you and makes you feel really helpless and drags you down and down and down. Probably don't read it if you already have eco-anxiety. It's not going to make you any better.
Yeah. So moving on to the next novel, The Promise by Damon Galgut. So this is another heavyweight. He's a 3-time Booker nominee from South Africa. And his story, his novel, follows a white South African family who are living on a farm outside Pretoria. It's divided into different sections, which are spaced out chronologically. So each section occurs several years apart. And the person for whom every chapter is named seems to end up dying in a chapter. It's quite bleak. So it begins with the funeral of Ma, the mother, the matriarch of the family. And in that first section, we also learn about the titular promise, which is a promise the family made to a black woman who had been working for the family her entire life. So they told her she could have her own house, but somehow over the years never quite seemed to fulfill this promise. So Galgut, who is also the author of The Good Doctor, he's a brilliant writer. And in this book, you know, the narrative moves fluidly from one character to another. Sometimes it can get a bit disorienting. So you see the word he, and you think, oh, wait, was it this guy? Actually, no, it was someone else. So it feels immersive in that sense. It's almost dreamlike. You feel like you are there in the novel witnessing the events in a kind of dreamlike state. So it's very smoothly written, very polished. And you can tell that Galgut has spent a long time crafting his prose, you know, from years of very astute observations of human life. So it is well written. Again, I found it was hard to get through to the end. I don't know whether it's just me this year or whether it's just the books that I happen to have picked for the podcast. But yeah, definitely a book to admire. Not sure if, it just didn't resonate with me in the end, unfortunately. So finally, it's time to talk about that interesting Twitter-inspired novel that has been polarizing. It has polarized readers. People say they either love it or hate it, or love it and hate it. So, Olivia, why don't you tell us more?
Well, I hated it and then I loved it. This is No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. So we're going to talk
Which
about
everyone
that
is talking
now.
About this.
Everyone is talking about that. Yeah. So like you observed earlier, most of the novels in the shortlist have been pretty standard when it comes to form. I think that this is maybe the only one that significantly experiments with it. It is a social media novel and it's written by somebody who has been immersed in the language of that world to this level of incredible fluidity. So this is Patricia Lockwood. She is a poet. She's the author of the memoir Priest Daddy, and she has a knack for going viral on Twitter. So I, for one, am a great fan of her cat, Miette, who I don't know if you know the You Kick Miette meme. It's the one where, because she has this cat, she's called Miette. She imagines Miette talks like a kind of Victorian orphan. And so in this tweet that she made, Miette was sitting in the way and she pushed Miette slightly with her foot to get her out of the way. And then Miette responds, she imagines. She goes, "You kick Miette? You kick her body like the football? Oh, jail for mother for 1,000 years." And this became this immortal meme, which is, I love it. Anyway, so this is Patricia Lockwood's debut novel. The unnamed narrator is this woman who has gone viral for her social media posts on very incomprehensible things like, can a dog be twins? And she thrives on her existence in The Portal, which is this online space where people ask each other, are we all just going to keep doing this till we die? Are we in hell? It's written in this very fragmentary form that mimics the infinite scroll of a social media feed. And this is something that may leave some readers frustrated a few pages in. What Lockwood is very good at is capturing, with its poetic hilarity, the absurd chaos of online existence, which is sometimes so bizarre, but wonderful, but bizarre. The narrator describes scrolling through her feed as having her arms all full of the sapphires of the instant, you know, especially when you've pit that against the backdrop of a real world on the verge of collapse, like, you know, Richard Powers' World in Bewilderment, for instance. I'm going to read one of these little chunks that come up in the text. When something of her sparked and spread in the portal, it blazed away the morning and afternoon. It blazed like the new California, which we had come to accept as being always on fire. She ran back and forth in the flames, not eating or drinking, emitting a high-pitched sound most humans couldn't hear. After a while, her husband might burst through that wall of swimming red to rescue her, but she would twist away and kick him in the nuts, screaming, "My whole life is in there," as the day she was standing on broke away and fell into the sea. So this is all quite funny, and if it's a little too familiar for certain people, if you, like me, are a child of the interwebs, but even the most social media savvy reader is, after all, going to question, what is the point of all of this? Which is also what the narrator is probably doing in the novel. Then we come to the Volta in the middle of the novel, and the narrator receives sudden terrible news that her sister's pregnancy has gone wrong, and her sister's baby is born with Proteus syndrome, which is this rare genetic disorder that the child is unlikely to survive. And then what happens here is this astonishing prismatic shift of perspective where everyone in the narrator's world just kind of contracts around the baby, and it causes her to reevaluate her entire worldview. And it's, it's not merely a litany of suffering. It could have been, because the tragedy of the situation is so terrible. But what happens is that the whole story becomes suffused with this immense and unbearable love for this child who's not going to live for very long. And it is based on, I think, the real story of Lockwood's family. She did have a niece, Lena, who had Proteus syndrome, who died. And in the book, the narrator's sister says of caring for the baby, she says, "I would have done it for 1,000,000 years. I would have gotten up every morning and given her 13 medicines. There is no relief. I would have done it for all time." I began this novel like, what the hell is going on? And then I ended it almost in tears. So this was a pretty stunning transformation, I think, from, you know, superficial to subliminal. And I'm still working out how I feel about it. I know I have a lot of feelings, very strong, very confusing feelings. But I guess that's, that's what you want books to do for you, that you want them to produce these feelings that I'm still working out. Yeah. So who is going to win the Booker Prize? I know that we always get this
we
wrong.
We always get this wrong.
Except Milkman. We did guess Milkman, I think.
We wanted it to win, but we thought it wouldn't. Yeah, but it won in the end. Yeah.
Yeah, so last year, Douglas Stewart won for Sugi Bane, and none of us saw that coming. But yeah, so who do you think is going to win?
I don't know. Maybe The Fortune Man, maybe The Great Circle. I mean, hopefully none of the ones I spoke about for this podcast. But you said The Great Circle is good, right? And if it's as great as you say it is, I hope it wins.
Well, who wins the Booker, we'll find out on November the 3rd. In the meantime, that's what we have for you for this episode. Once again, thank you for listening to us. I'm Olivia Ho.
And I'm Towin Lee.
You have been listening to our Bookmark This podcast, which you can subscribe to on your favorite smartphone audio apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Like us and rate us. We'll catch you next time.
That was an SBH podcast by The Straits Times. Find us on Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or streaming on Google Home. Do feedback to us at podcast@sbh.com.sg.
You can also check out more podcasts on various topics at The Straits Times, The Business Times, and Money FM 89.3.